Dr. Mike Lenore with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer for men. African American men are more at risk. That's primarily because it's often diagnosed when it's more advanced. The good news is that diagnosed early, most prostate cancer can be treated effectively. If you're a man over 50 or have a family history of prostate cancer, talk to your doctor today about a test. For more information, visit aawellnessproject.org. Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Lenore with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer for men. African American men are more at risk. That's primarily because it's often diagnosed when it's more advanced. The good news is that diagnosed early, most prostate cancer can be treated effectively. If you're a man over 50 or have a family history of prostate cancer, talk to your doctor today about a test. For more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, welcome to Forbes Avenue. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and today I have Rachel Curry here with me. So, specifically what I'm going
to... Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon. Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today's episode will be a continuation of the conversation that Rihanna Duncan and I had with Professors Christopher Mark Jones, an emeritus professor of French and Francophone Studies from Carnegie Mellon University, and Marcy Persine, an assistant professor of classics at the University of Pittsburgh that has been one of Rihanna's professors. Here comes part two of our discussion of translation and various other language issues.
Isn't there a sense between some different languages that one language is looked down on by the speakers of the other language?
I think that's historically true. And, of course, it tends to be hemisphere-based, you know, if you look at colonial history and so forth, and even the way colonial history has translated itself into contemporary social realities in Africa, well, or the Americas as well. You don't have to look too far. Whether, and that's, so you, there you can talk about indigenous languages, for example, which Worf would have said they were equally as rich as any of the Indo-European language tree. So there's a sort of imperialism which reflects itself in language and culture. In other words, when the French went to Africa, what did they bring? They brought the church. So their schools were pretty much missionaries who were teaching French and the culture of la mère patrie, the mother country, France, to people in Mali and Senegal and so forth.
Wasn't just the French. I mean, the Belgians did that too. The Germans did that as well. The English did that as well. The Portuguese, yeah.
Absolutely. And there was no monopoly on this kind of cultural imperialism, but the language went with it. And now, you know, what is the national language of Senegal? Well, it's French, but there are probably dozens of indigenous languages still spoken, and some in a significant way, like Wolof and so forth, so that the uses to which language is put, in other words, there's the language of diplomacy, which used to be French. Now English is pretty much the language of everything, commerce, diplomacy, and the list goes on. Of course, when I first went over to Portugal, I went as a professional basketball player. Within 6 weeks, I had to give practices in Portuguese. That was not easy. I went back 20 years later, the small town where I first played and where, as I've mentioned, there were no English speakers. And I was invited to a game and then invited to go in and give a little talk to the team. So I walked into the locker room and started addressing them in Portuguese. And then I realized that other than two guys down at the end of the bench, no one knew what I was talking about. The coach was an Anglophone. All of the players, there were three Americans, two Lithuanians, a Spaniard, a Serb, and two Portuguese. Their entire universe was in English. This was in a small town in Portugal. And I said, oh, and spoke to them in English, you know.
It's interesting because, to your question, these power dynamics exist also within individual languages because of cultural imperialism and linguistic imperialism, which I'm so, you've elucidated so well, Chris. But, you know, I think about how when I was learning Spanish, I was learning Spanish in high school in South Texas, and I was taught Mexican Spanish as the default pronunciation and vocabulary words of choice. And it was not until many years later in college and in graduate school that I was really truly exposed to Spain-based Spanish and to Catalan and to other dialects of Spanish and became aware of the biases and the condescension and the tension between the languages that reflect this colonized-colonizer dynamic that I was very unaware of as a 13 and 14-year-old learning the language for the first time. But the same is even true, you know, we can think about just the geographic span between Mexico and Spain is vast. But those same dynamics might occur in modern Italian, where you have dialects in Rome that are different from the dialects in Naples, that are different from the dialects of Sicily. And generally speaking, the further south you get in Italy, the more derided by the northerners your dialect of Italian is likely to be. And this also reflects cultural power dynamics, because the closer you were to Milan, to Venice, to Rome, the more likely you were to have powerful connections as far back as the Crusades.
Don't we have that in America with the different accents and the dialects of English spoken here?
We do, but I would say I'm not sure it's as bad as in the UK, though, where you have the public school accent, meaning the private exclusive for the aristocracy and their descendants, and then working class, you know, East London accents and so forth. That's quite extreme differences. Of course, in French, you know, you've got le Parisien and everything else, you know. In other words, the French Revolution intent was a leveler. They wanted everyone to speak and write the same way. Well, people don't evolve that way. And, of course, they sent a bunch of people over to Quebec, then essentially cut them off without a dime for a century or so. So they evolved. And now when the Quebecers go back to France, they get insulted by, c'est pas du français, ça. It's not, that's not French. In spite of the fact they are native speakers of French and have a really unique and beautiful, albeit very distinct way of expressing themselves.
Get the sense in America that the versions of English that are spoken in the African American and the immigrant American community are the ones that are really looked down on.
Yep. And in any lower economic bracket, for that matter, too. You point to the South, but it's, you know, there are class-based accents in the South. There are the Southern Belle versus the non-Southern Belle Southern accents, right? Or you might think, we're in Pittsburgh, we might think of the Appalachian accent as a good parallel, where the Appalachian accent is distinct from, say, what you encounter in urban cities of the same space, same geographic space. It is interesting, though. I know, I reset us to the year 100, but the prioritizing and the politicizing of one's primary language, of the language of the colonizer, it's not inevitable. There's this broader attitude, especially in those early centuries of contact between the Roman Empire as a colonizing power and Greece, the mainland, and the extended Hellenic world, or the Oikoumene, as it was regularly called after the conquest of Alexander. Because when Alexander takes over the eastern half of the Mediterranean, he basically installs laissez-faire government systems. So in Persia, he says, you have satrapies, they can stay, but I want all of the decrees in Greek. And so you see the development of Koine Greek, which is common Greek. That's all that Koine means. When the Romans, specifically Julius Caesar, follow in the footsteps of Alexander and they take over the Oikoumeni, where Koine Greek is already practiced as the default legal language, the Romans say, well, we can understand Greek, so this can stay as it is. So it's only in occasional spaces for specific legal purposes that you see Latin as the de facto legal language. So, for example, in Egypt, you see Latin being prioritized for divorce cases. But Egypt is an interesting space because most legal codes during the Roman Empire are left in Greek, but all tax codes are still in native Egyptian, because Alexander was too busy taking over the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean to rewrite the tax codes. But you end up with this Roman Empire that is a Latin-speaking population for its rulership, at least for the first 300 years or so, who are perfectly content to let the eastern half of the Mediterranean continue to use Greek.
That sounds like a different story than what Christopher was talking about when European countries colonized Africa or North America or South America.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's different. I'm not sure about the economic reality of, but I'm assuming that those conquerors also had in mind lucre, right? Mm-hmm. Just like the colonial system was a system of exchange of raw materials for manufactured materials to the benefit of the mother country. Once they got through all looking for gold and stuff with the Incas and the Mayas. But so there's that power imbalance, which always works in favor of the colonizer. And Alexander was not looking to lift up the population for there.
Absolutely not. So it's the same colonizing force executed slightly differently on the linguistic plane.
Yeah.
Brianna, we've ended up talking about language as a window into seeing all sorts of different things about culture.
Well, I feel like the thing is that language is inherently powerful, and it inherently carries out power dynamics, whether that be the difference in accents, or and therefore a bunch of code switching, or imperialism, meaning that people now have to speak another language.
Well, the code switching notion, you know, is an interesting one. Code switching, in my experience, just means using multiple language in the same utterance, for example. And it's looked down upon in educated spaces, in other words, but is quite common. In my own experience, for example, in Portugal, it did not happen until very recently. But in Montreal, for example, you walk into a shop. Now, you know how you are greeted. Bonjour, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Both.
Now, for the defenders of the French language, this is a mortal insult, but it is daily practice in commerce. And that gives you, as the interlocutor of the salesperson, the option of saying, I'm looking for some socks, or je cherche des chaussettes, vous en avez dans ma taille. You can go either way. Mm-hmm. In other words, in Quebec, where there is the defense of the French language, which is often right in front of mind, that sort of flexibility is threatening. But you see code switching. In Montreal, most people are bilingual. And so they will routinely, if they can't think of a word in French, they will throw it in the English word. And then if you get into the arts, I did a lot of study of Francophone popular music, especially in Quebec, rap, for example. You can have people who will use an indigenous language, Arabic, Spanish, French, and English. That's not necessarily all in the same rap,
but potentially in the same.
Potentially.
Yes.
And often in multiples. and Creole, too, of course, because Creole is quite prevalent.
So you'd call it code switching when you're on the bus and you overhear somebody in a conversation in Arabic saying, okay, and...
And I think Christopher's very, very right to highlight that the more diverse or the more bilingual a space is, the more code switching can occur. And to Riona's opening point, it also doesn't have to happen between languages. It can happen within an individual language. So this gets into the dialects issue again, and also to cultural norms and socioeconomics, etc. But so, for example, in English, someone from South Texas, if I'm really like leaning into my roots, I might say, y'all fixing to eat yet? And in a academic setting, I would be very unlikely to say that same expression using those words in that cadence that quickly. I'd be more likely to say, are y'all about to eat? Or are you about to eat? Or are yins about to eat? And see, that's an additional code switch, because now I'm taking on the Pittsburgher cap and trying to utilize an indigenous term for y'all, the equivalent.
Right. Well, that's the whole question of register, of course, yes. You know, so that code switching between registers, my experience being a jock, a musician, an academic, you know, and so you're talking to a bunch of hoopers, mm-hmm. There's going to be more profanity. You're going to be, the subjects that you discuss will be somewhat limited. Although I always defend intelligent jocks because they do exist.
And jock musicians apparently exist
jock
as
musicians
well.
As well, absolutely. So, but yeah, the registers, the social registers, which everybody knows, yes. Multiples, some maybe only two. They know that when they're talking to grandma,
right,
they're not supposed to swear.
Right. To your point, too, about the purpose of code switching, the purposes can vary. So Christopher's example is a utility-based code switch, saying bonjour, hi, so that your customer knows which language they can opt for, that there's aptitude in both, is utility-based. But you might be on the phone with your grandmother and utilize a native or a heritage term to refer to her instead of saying grandma. Or you might say Mitchin, for example, which is Flemish, as a tone of endearment. And then that is a code switch that is used for emotive purpose. Or you might use it because you're multilingual and you can't find the damn word that you're looking for in the language you're speaking, so it comes to your mind in Greek or in Latin or in French or in Chinese or etc. But what's cool, what's so interesting, is that in sociolinguistics, they've determined that, generally speaking, you code switch either to create distance from someone. So you use a word because the people around you won't know what you're saying. Or you do it for the opposite reason, which is to create a closer connection with someone, because you know, okay, if I switch to Creole French and you know what I'm saying, I've just created a connection with you. I've just flagged that we have this commonality. And so code switching is this beautiful subtext of language to operate within language.
So we're here on Forbes Avenue talking with Marcy Persine, who's assistant professor in classics at the University of Pittsburgh, and Christopher Jones, who is emeritus professor of French and Francophone studies here at CMU. We've really been talking about language in the mind and translation, so I thought I would ask if you had opinions about language that doesn't really go through human minds, like the role of AI in translation.
Well, machine or computer-assisted translation as a practice didn't arrive with AI. And when I came here in 93, for example, it was well underway in computer science and so forth. And you could say anything like Google Translate, or, you know, there are multiples that are there which are not as powerful and don't use anywhere near as much fossil fuel to to make them work. I worked in intelligent tutoring systems here with people from computer science. And so the whole notion of creating a body of knowledge and modeling that body of knowledge and releasing stimuli to students based on that constructed body of knowledge, which the computer was keeping track of, which a teacher also does, of course, but mm-hmm. That's not foreign to me. What's happening with AI is the artificial intelligence is able to learn on its own if it's fed. if it's fed. And of course, as a songwriter and a writer, the artificial intelligence needs to be fed existing texts, mm-hmm. which were actually authored by humans, but which ends up causing an enhanced capacity in the artificial intelligence, which it then can turn around and do Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Not really, but, you know, maybe not Shakespeare, but can do Queen.
A pastiche of Shakespeare
and fool a lot of people. Previously, the computer would spit out something and you'd say, okay, yeah, give me a couple hours and I'll put this into a final shape. Now with AI, it's instead of being 75% final, it's now 97% final to the extent that a professor might not know that the paper written for that assignment was not actually written by Bobby or Jeannie, but rather Robobby, you know, so to speak.
Robobby.
I just made that up.
I love that, though. I really appreciate your point, especially about how generative AI and language corpus tools are by nature of how they are constructed, machines designed for plagiarizing, right? They have to be fed something created by humans at some point in order to create something that is new, but all the parts are old. So in that sense, what ChatGPT or any of these AI tools do is they give you a quilt rather than a brand new fabric. And what humans can do with language is create a new fabric. That doesn't mean the quilt's not useful. And it doesn't mean that there's not, you know, potentially good purposes for AI too, although your point about the fossil fuels and the energy consumption is also very on the nose because it's deeply alarming. In learning languages, if you are not thrust into a space of immersion, the fear of failure is such an obstacle. You know, to walk into even like Gabby et Jules and order in French in Pittsburgh is very challenging and frightening. But to go on Duolingo and speak into a mic and have a bot respond to you in what feels like more or less canned French, a conversation you might drill and practice until you know it, that can overcome the fear of failure. So, you know, generative AI is kind of regenerative rather than generative, to your point, but there are definitely some uses to it that feel less destructive, but there's also no actual originality to it as it exists right now.
That's a good point, though, that it can assist people in learning the language or getting you a rough translation that you can get a native speaker to help you sort it out so you haven't offended anybody in that language.
Absolutely. It's a good starting point or a good intermediary for sure. In the same way that Google Translate can be a very useful intermediary to start with. Mm-hmm. So, but you also might get some confused looks when you start speaking French in the form of Voltaire, because Voltaire is, of course, copyright free. There might be some lingering aspects of it in ChatGPT that, you know, just surface from time to time.
What about the global media? How's that affecting all the current languages?
Well, I also consume media. Just because my work is in the ancient world doesn't mean I'm dead. I do still, you know, watch, you know, Miyazaki films or K-dramas, or as you see globalization occur and more and more and more materials in their original languages available, Turkish dramas. Oh my God, amazing. It's easier to put yourself into spaces of immersion where, you know, you can turn on the subtitles. But eventually you might be doing the dishes while you're watching your Turkish drama and realizing that, oh, I actually don't need to read these English subtitles as much as I thought that I did, because I've been binge watching 5 seasons of historic romance that's all in Turkish.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to have the subtitles for those Hindi dramas I'm watching.
I guess you haven't watched enough.
Yeah, that's right.
This is me empowering you to watch more.
Just watch more, Richard.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think back. I mean, remember, how old is the internet? And how old is the World Wide Web? Not that old. Older than you are.
Yeah.
Okay. But just barely, right? I mean, You know, the fact is that we're not talking Roman Empire here. We're talking very recent history. And one of the main concerns outside of Anglo-Saxon spaces was that the World Wide Web and the Internet were going to be English, you know, and it was going to be another example of cultural and linguistic imperialism. And now that has not turned out to be the case, although there's still probably a predominance of English interaction, right? Even in international, between spaces who don't actually speak English. And of course, speaking, learning a language via media, that's not an easy way to go, because it's never easy to do that, but it is certainly feasible.
You know, something that we've sort of been circling around, and I'd love to pick everyone's brain about, is the role of education in the way that we prioritize language. You know, there are languages that we predominantly use in classrooms, and there are languages that are predominantly spoken in households or in churches or in community centers or in, you know, gatherings that are all elders or all women. And these sort of different spaces activate different power dynamics. So one of the reasons why English has this almost chokehold on Americans' linguistic capacity is because English is taught as the de facto language in every public school in the country.
But of course, in North America, Quebec is the counterexample, where math and science and history and so forth are taught in French.
Yes.
And yet they're constantly battling against the wave of English.
I get the sense that even by the time my son, who's in his mid-30s, by the time he was in high school in America, languages were devalued, and people were only taking them because they had to take 2 years to have on their application to a four-year college.
Clearly, the value of language has shifted from my youth to today. Because the value of language, you could say, if I had actually been a Portuguese speaker, I could have gone right in, made myself a... I'm remembered for having integrated myself into Portuguese life. That was that massive effort with almost no preparation. Today, what would be the value of arriving with decent Portuguese? The Portuguese would speak to you in English. In France, I used to take students to a summer program. We'd arrive in Paris, and I'd say, hey, go get a coffee. We'll meet back here and take the train out to Strasbourg. They'd come back in tears because the waitress had insulted their French in French. Mm-hmm. Now that same waitress would have spoken to them in English. They would have had no opportunity even to be insulted, you know. So that is a huge difference. And you speak of educationally. Well, how do you get that immersion experience if you're coming from an Anglophone environment? If you're coming from the University of Pittsburgh, you're coming from Carnegie Mellon, and you're going to a major European capital, people will speak to you in English. Mm-hmm. The moment they hear an accent.
I had a friend recently who studied abroad in France, and she didn't speak a lick of French while she was there. She said the only thing she had to be careful was in the line to the club. Mm-hmm. If she spoke English, she might get turned away. But if she had her friends without accents speak, then she could get in and continue living French free.
I mean, to a certain extent, that's a classic story where the American kids go over and they all hang around in a cloud and just speak to each other and don't actually get any immersion experience whatsoever. But that was a lot harder to do even 20 years ago or so.
Although I do also wonder, I am just as prone to this as anyone else, so I promise I'm not pointing fingers, but with the rise of travel influencers on Instagram sending us to further and further obscure places off the beaten track, as it were, you know, I feel like it might be difficult to speak French in Paris, but it might be difficult not to speak French if you are outside of one of these major metropolitan spaces in France. And, you know, to circle back to the question of what the value of these languages are and learning second and third and fourth languages, you know, we could talk about, you know, the ways in which, say,
you know, learning computer coding helps your brain develop different ways, new wrinkles, as I like to put it.
Or Christopher and I would say learning to play music develops different things.
Exactly. Or learning mathematics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we all have calculators in our phones. Why do we need to learn basic multiplication rules? Well, it helps your brain develop, and it helps you hold different forms of critical thinking. And that's kind of getting on the higher tier of pedagogical reasoning for why languages are important. But there's also this fact that, you know, as much as the U.S. seems like a monolinguistic space, and as much as English is a lingua franca, there will always be people in the world you can't speak to unless you reach out and try to learn at least hello, bonjour, you know, ni hao, whatever language it is. And maybe that's your grandmother. Maybe that's your aunt. Maybe that's, you know, the person sitting next to you on the train who's reading a book that looks really interesting. Perhaps, you know, having these tools at our fingertips that can give us shorthands for translations can make, you know, those moments more approachable without the language learning. But I think the language learning is still important, so you know how to use the tools, know what is the appropriate way to implement the tools. Yeah, it's such a good question.
This has just been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Marcy Person from Pitt, and Christopher Mark Jones from CMU.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
It was an utter joy. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
In my opinion, Israel controls Middle East policy in the United States. Trump is in the pocket of Netanyahu, it seems. Without U.S. military support, Israel would not have been able to maintain their slaughter of Gaza for more than a few months. The United States enables Israel to ignore international law and to reject every single peace agreement. This is not an exaggeration.
That's Richard Forer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. Noam Chomsky calls the Israel, U.S., and Palestine relationship a fateful triangle. He says, in no other region of the world are the problems so likely to lead to devastating regional conflict. He adds, those problems have only been aggravated by the irrationality and intolerance that has dominated discussion in the United States. It will be unfortunate, Chomsky warns, if this state of affairs persists. Chomsky wrote those words more than 50 years ago. The U.S. has given Israel hundreds of billions of dollars in aid over the years. In addition, Washington provides crucial diplomatic, political, and military support. Internationally, because of Gaza, both the U.S. and Israel are increasingly isolated. Moshe Yalon, former Israeli chief of staff and defense minister, says Israel is committing war crimes and ethnic cleansing. Our guest today is Richard Forer. He spent time in the West Bank and Gaza. He has Orthodox Jewish relatives living in West Bank settlements. He's a former member of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. He's the author of Wake Up, Essays on the Tragedy of Israel-Palestine, winner of the New York Big Book Award. I talked with Richard Forer at the Boulder Public Library in late March. I want to welcome Richard Forer to the program. Good
Thank
to
you,
see
David.
You again,
Same
Richard.
Here.
Anti-Semitism, what is it?
Well, traditionally, anti-Semitism was hatred of Jews because they were Jews. And now it's become, well, to quote Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which calls itself the largest Jewish civil rights organization in the world, Greenblatt specifically said anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. But really what he means is you're an anti-Semite if you are anti-Jewish supremacy. They're taking criticism of Israel to be anti-Semitic because Israel is a Jewish supremacist state. And it does not confer equal rights to all of its citizens, only to Jews. When I was growing up, and this applies to pretty much all Jews of my generation, and probably certainly generations before me, and probably generations after me. I thought Zionism was a movement to protect Jews from further persecution. So from that point of view, and not having studied the history, because most people haven't studied the history, I never did until 2006. I was ignorant. I thought Israel was an innocent country just trying to make peace with its Arab neighbors who were anti-Semitic. But from the point of view of someone who believes that Israel was a necessary haven from the perils of anti-Semitism, from thousands of years of persecution, I can understand why a Jewish person would react to criticism of Israel. However, the last 20 years or so, especially since Netanyahu has been prime minister, have shown just how cruel, insensitive, inhumane, and bigoted Israel is. So when people call us, anyone who criticizes Israel, we're basically ipso facto anti-Semites. What they're really doing is denying their own bigotry and projecting it onto us. I have a principle that I talk about in my book, which one of the universal principles I cite is that the real enemy is not someone or something outside of us. The real enemy is the unexamined mind that unconsciously projects its suffering onto the other and then blames and scapegoats the other for its suffering. And so what people are doing when they call us anti-Semites, it's a reflex. They've never studied the history. They don't know us. They don't know what motivates us to criticize Israel, really, because they're too blind to our humanity. But what they are doing is, it's a reflex, so they don't have to consider the fact that their support for Israel is inhumane, that what they are doing is exactly what they are saying that we are doing and exactly what they would say the Nazis did. Okay, so they are trying to protect themselves from their own conscience and from their own inhumanity. For example, if Defense for Children International, and they're not the only organization, but they focus on children, when they speak about the suffering of children, the abuse of children by the Israeli military and by settlers, they're called anti-Semitic. We are called anti-Semites if we care about children. And so, for example, in my book, I talk about how Human Rights Watch said that Israel's treatment of children would terrify and traumatize any adult. So if I were to say that to a supporter of Israel, they would call me an anti-Semite. They would accuse me of belittling and slandering Israel. Anti-Semitism is not whether or not people who criticize Israel are anti-Semites. The real issue is what is going on in the minds of the accusers. They are the bigots who are projecting their bigotry onto us and calling us what is true of them.
So people like Norman Finkelstein, Noam Chomsky, Amy Goodman, Medea Benjamin, yourself, are then put in a different category because you can't be anti-Semitic. You happen to be Jewish, so you're a self-hating Jew.
That, yes, although actually Jonathan Greenblatt, again, he referred to the JVP demonstrators in New York City, most of whom were Jewish, demonstrating against the genocide. He referred to them as anti-Semites. In other words, even if you're a Jew, you're an anti-Semite if you don't simply support what Israel is doing. If you don't remain blind and ignorant, as Jonathan Greenblatt is. So that's why he's obviously an educated person. And yet he doesn't know anything about the history. And you know why he doesn't know anything about the history? Because he doesn't want to know anything about the history. Because anything he would find out about the history would reflect upon his self-imagery. And it's self-imagery that is the heart of all of this suffering. That's the reason why, for example, I don't want to talk too much about him, but my identical twin brother cannot hear anything. To him, every Arab wants to kill every Jew. So he has a self-image of himself, as do most Jews, as being fair and humane people. I always thought I was fair and humane. I didn't think that I was a bigot. I didn't think that my criticism of Palestinians was because I was insensitive or prejudiced. I just thought they were psychopaths. Okay? But they weren't. And speaking of that, Benny Morris, the famous Israeli historian, calls Palestinians serial killers and psychopaths. That's why For him, his self-image does not require that he see all people as equal. His self-image includes the fact that Jews are superior. Most American Jews, certainly myself and my friends growing up, we never really saw ourselves as superior. Maybe we saw ourselves as a bit more moral than the Goyim who had tried to destroy the Jewish people. But we didn't think that we were prejudiced against Palestinians or Arabs. We just thought they were anti-Semites who wanted to destroy the state of Israel and world Jewry, just like the Nazis had done. So it boils down to self-imagery. If you have a self-image of yourself as fair and humane, you're going to project and you support Israel. You're going to see Israel the way you see yourself. But what you are really not seeing is the real Israel. You are seeing a projection of Israel, of your idealistic images. That's what you're seeing. These people don't see Israel. They don't care about Israel. They see their self-imagery, and they see and they care about their own ego identity. They care about protecting and preserving this illusion that they have of who they are. And it's an illusion because they're not fair and humane. That is a belief system, as is the way they identify themselves. And the crux of the matter is, will people wake up and look in the mirror, or are they going to simply defend their own self-imagery, even in the face of thousands and thousands of children being killed, slaughtered, and other people dying?
Of Donald Trump, you write in your book that he has a history of Islamophobic and anti-Semitic pronouncements. Can you give some examples?
Yeah.
And what does that say about the political culture of the United States in 2025?
Yeah. Well, just 2 weeks ago, he called Chuck Schumer one of Israel's strongest supporters. He said that Chuck Schumer had become a Palestinian. But throughout his career, there was the Muslim ban. He'd wanted to prevent all Muslims from coming into the country. He was trashing Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib when he was president. He called for a database of every American Muslim, or I should say every Muslim living in the United States, and he wanted to surveil every mosque in the United States. And this is really probably just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, Trump believes what he's told by Miriam Adelson and Netanyahu and the prevailing beliefs of the neocons. He just believes it. Since he doesn't read anything, and since he doesn't contemplate anything, he just believes it. And of course, by believing it, he reaps monetary benefit, like he has from the Adelsons, for example.
Explain who Miriam Adelson is.
Okay, Miriam Adelson is the widow of Sheldon Adelson, who was a billionaire, casino owner, Las Vegas, Macau. And in 2016, the Adelsons gave $27 million directly to Trump's campaign and at least double that to the Republican National Committee on the condition that if Donald Trump were elected president, he moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which he did. And then Miriam Adelson, in the latest election against Kamala, Miriam Adelson put in over $100 million into a super PAC, and her condition was that Donald Trump, if elected president, recognize and allow Israel's annexation of the West Bank. Okay, which, by the way, Itamar Ben-Gavir, who's going to rejoin the Netanyahu coalition, since Netanyahu has violated phase two of the ceasefire, Itamar Ben-Gavir just introduced a bill in the Knesset to void the Oslo Accords, the Y River Memorandum, and the Hebron Protocols, which gave some land to the Palestinians. So he wants to eliminate the legal basis for the Palestinians being on some of this land as a prelude to annexation. And exactly 1 year ago, Bezalel Smotrich, who's in the coalition, the Minister of Finance, who was also in charge of the occupation of the West Bank, 1 year ago, they seized, the state of Israel seized, I think it was 3.8 square miles of Palestinian land in the West Bank, the largest seizure of land since the Oslo Accords. And of course, the Oslo Accords, the land giveaway was Area C, for the most part, which is 61% of the West Bank and is under Israeli administrative and military control. What we're seeing now is not just the inevitable, predictable violation of the ceasefire, and Tamir Pardo, Israel's former Mossad chief, just said that Netanyahu violated the ceasefire because he doesn't care about the Israeli people. He only cares about retaining his position as prime minister. So he
and that position would be threatened because he's charged with criminal activities.
Well, he's charged with criminal activities, but also killing people in Gaza and attacking Gaza. It's much harder for the Knesset to call for elections. He also knows that by doing it, he's keeping Bezalel Smotrich in the coalition. So when Netanyahu signed the ceasefire under Trump's orders in January, and Trump told him he could do whatever he wanted after phase one, but when Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire, Itamar Ben-Gvir left the coalition and took his Knesset votes with him. But Gideon Saar entered the coalition, so Netanyahu still had a majority in the Knesset. Bezalel Smotrich, though, told Netanyahu, I will stay in the coalition under these conditions. And the conditions were, which Netanyahu loved, you cannot proceed beyond phase one. You cannot continue to phase two. You have to attack. Number two, you have to give me greater authority to expand settlements in the West Bank and to ethnically cleanse Palestinians. And this is exactly what they're doing. A week or two ago, Israel, maybe it was 3 weeks ago, in Jenin mostly, Israel expelled over 40,000 Palestinians and said, you're never going to come back. I don't know where they went. And then they've invaded other Tokaram, and they invaded areas of Nablus. And this is just a process. This is the inevitable conclusion of the Zionist project, which was always based on the world as anti-Semitic, and the only way we Jews can live in peace is to get rid of the Goyim. So this is the inevitable conclusion. They want to expel the Palestinians. And the amazing thing is that their greatest supporters are anti-Semites, the Christian evangelicals, who believe that Jews have to go to hell unless they become Christians when Jesus returns. And Theodor Herzl predicted this. Theodor Herzl said that the anti-Semites will become our best friends. And that was pretty much true from the beginning, because Herzl called religious Jews kikes, which is about the worst word you can use for a Jew. He said they were disgusting, unspeakable. If you read Theodor Herzl's comments about religious Jews, if you didn't know it was Herzl, you would think it was Adolf Hitler. But what Herzl understood was that the religious Jews detested Zionism, because to the religious Jews, only God, through the Moshiach from the house of King David, only the Moshiach can create a Jewish state. A Jewish state cannot be created by man. Zionism is blood and soil, just like the Nazis. Zionism is a nationalistic movement to create a Jewish state without regard to the Torah. So Herzl was an atheist. He didn't circumcise his son. He told the Pope, he literally told the Pope, that if the Pope would help him find a piece of land for the Jewish people, he would have them converted to Roman Catholicism. So my point is that the Zionist movement from the very beginning was supported by the Christian Zionists. Christian Zionism preceded Jewish Zionism, because the Christian Zionists wanted the Jews to leave. They wanted them out of Europe. So that's why Theodor Herzl was saying that the anti-Semites would be the Jews' best friends. And so this is really what has happened. During World War II, Yitzhak Shamir, who was the head of the Stern Gang and became prime minister after Menachem Begin, who was the head of the Irgun, Jewish terrorist gangs, Shamir's people went to the Nazis and said, look, you believe in the Aryan race, that they're superior. We believe Jews are superior. You want to get rid of the Jews? Fine. Send them to us. Send them to Palestine. So there was always this kind of connection in a perverse way between Zionism and Nazism. And as the U.S. State Department said in 1944, they are very similar. They are both based on blood and soil.
Blut und Boden, I think, is the German. Now, Gábor Máté is a very interesting figure. He's a Hungarian-born Jew. He's a physicist, author. He's based in Vancouver, British Columbia. And in a recent alternative radio program, he talked about how can Jews of all people support and rationalize genocide. And then you respond, what people really want to know is why? Why do my relatives who always have supported civil rights, why do they support Israel? Why do rabbis who talk about Jewish values and tikkun olam, you can translate that, that's Hebrew, why do they support Netanyahu and Jewish supremacy? Why?
Tikkun olam is healing the world. There's another term in Judaism called dira betachtonim, which is to make a dwelling place for the divine. So from the point of view of certain Hasidic Jewish sects, the reason the Jews are chosen is to make of the world, to make the world a dwelling place for the divine. But these sects are among the most virulently anti-Palestinian. So they are obviously misunderstanding the wisdom of their own teachings, because they are taking their teachings and making their teachings conform to their ego rather than surrendering their ego to the wisdom of the teachings. But in answer to that question, it's all about self-imagery. From the very beginning, Israel accused the Arabs, Nasser in particular, Gamal Abdel Nasser, the head of Egypt. From the very beginning, they accused the Arabs of wanting to finish what the Nazis had started. And even today, you will constantly hear Knesset members, rabbis, refer to Arabs or Palestinians as Nazis. And so they have this image as Nazis. So that's why my answer to Gábor Máté, the reason people support all this, these horrors, is because they think they're just defending themselves from Nazis. And it's the same reason they don't believe. For the most part, they either don't believe that Israel is literally, deliberately killing children and unarmed civilians. They think that's another slur. But even if they, even those who believe it, well, then they'll rationalize it. I've heard people, and it's more Israeli Jews than American Jews, because Israeli Jews are really brought up from birth to see the Palestinians as a mortal threat to them. Okay, but I have seen articulate Israelis on YouTube say things like, if I could push a button right now and kill every single Palestinian, I would do it. And I think most Jews in Israel would do it too. I've heard people say that stuff. And there are, Al Jazeera has compiled a list of at least 2,500 videos from Jewish soldiers bragging about killing children and killing civilians. That little girl, there's a human rights organization in Belgium named after her, and they submitted a brief to the International Court of Justice with 1,000 names and videos of Israeli soldiers bragging about murdering children and other civilians as part of the case against Israel, against Netanyahu and Gallant, and there should be others, for genocide. But again, it all boils down to self-imagery. We see the world through the prism of our ego, or of our ego identity, our self-imagery. This is why it's impossible for so many Jews to believe that even Netanyahu, that even their leaders could possibly do to the Palestinians or to anyone what has been done to them. They just cannot see it because it's not even a part of their frame of reference. It's almost like the Native Americans when the ships first came to the New World in the 1400s. They didn't see them because they had no concept. And they were out in the ocean and they could not see that there were ships there. They saw the men when they approached and entered the shore, but they couldn't see the ships. It's very similar to that.
Discuss, too, the paradox of victims becoming persecutors.
One of the things that was really central to Israel's establishment was power. Israel always knew, or at least thought they knew, that they had to have immense power so that nobody could ever screw the Jews again like the Nazis had and like the Russian Cossacks had with all the pogroms for the years and all the other enemies of the Jews throughout history, many of whom, it's fictitious. A lot of the history has been debunked. But yes, the Cossacks, in particular the Ukrainians, and the Nazis, of course, were extremely cruel to Jews. So, in their trauma and the need to create a Jewish state, they determined that they had to have immense power so no one could screw with them again. But what is really amazing is the vast majority of Jews didn't want a Jewish state. Okay, it was only because the Zionist organizations prevented Western Europe and the United States from taking in Jews after the Holocaust that Israel was able to become a state, because the Jews had nowhere to go. They were forced to go to Palestine. In 1947, 55,000 Jews applied to immigrate to the United States. And the vast, vast majority of them said that if they couldn't go to the United States, they'd go anywhere but Israel, but Palestine. Okay, so there was this great... So it was a con job by the Zionist movement. They conned the world into establishing Israel, and they conned the Jewish people, or forced the Jewish a lot of the Jewish people to go there, so there would be a large enough population that the UN would vote for a partitioned Jewish state, which was the prelude to the establishment in 1948 of the State of Israel.
Angela Davis once told me, victimization cannot be permitted to function as a halo of innocence. Is that operative in this instance?
What I should say, if you have the self-image of yourself as a victim, you will draw events to yourself, or you will interpret events in a way that confirms to yourself that you really are a victim. In the case of Israelis, they're victims, they're perpetrators, and all of this has to do with the stories they've told themselves about Jewish persecution, in particular, the Holocaust. Gabor Maté talks about trauma a lot, and I agree with him, but a lot of the trauma is self-traumatization. Israelis are traumatizing themselves with the stories they tell themselves. Okay, you know, when you grow up as a kid and you're taught by your school teachers, probably your parents, and certainly the government, that the world hates Jews, that you have to protect yourselves against the Palestinians because they're serial killers and psychopaths. That's why you need a wall. That's why you need to confine them. That's why you need to keep ethnically cleansing them to get rid of them. When you're taught all that from the time you're a little child, it becomes self-evident to you. That's how you're going to see the Palestinians. Not only that, it's not even something that you could even question. It's kind of like a lot of people automatically take for granted that there's a God and that you're going to go to heaven. And it's something they don't even question. It's certainly something they've never inquired into, you know, within themselves. They just believe it because they were taught it as children, and they cannot conceive that anything other than that could be true.
The younger generation, at least in the United States, of Jews seems to be struggling to establish some distance with the state of Israel. I'm thinking of Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, and then the actions, for example, occupying the Trump Tower in New York, Grand Central Station in New York, demonstrations in D.C. There seems to be some ferment there. What's causing that?
The younger generation is farther removed from the horrors of the Holocaust, number one. Number two, they've probably interacted more with Muslims and Arabs, because there's a lot of Muslims and Arabs in this country now. And also, they are a majority. Jews under the age of 40 in this country, a majority, oppose what Israel is doing. How long that can continue or how effective that can be under Trump, I don't know, because they're starting to arrest people. I predict that there's going to be a lot more violence in this country. I actually think that Trump would like to see more violence in this country against people that he opposes, against people who don't vote for him. Okay, and I can see that it's possible that as these demonstrations, if they continue, that there will be more violence. You know, just like there was violence on UCLA's campus, which, by the way, a lot of Hasidic Jews started the violence. Most of the demonstrators against the genocide on the UCLA campus were peaceful. And then a bunch of Hasidic Jews and police came in, and they started the violence there, just as there was a lot of violence started by non-demonstrators at Columbia.
So. I'm going to interject a poem here that I think speaks to this moment that we're in. It's from Pastor Martin Niemöller. He was part of the anti-Nazi German resistance. He was imprisoned from 1937 to 1945. First they came for the communists, and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews. I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. A poem for this moment. You're listening to Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org. And another poem that I'd like to read is from the Palestinian national poet, Mahmoud Darwish. It's called "The Earth is Closing In on Us." The earth is closing in on us, pushing us through the last passage. Where should we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky? Mahmoud Darwish was a great poet who died a few years ago, and this is one of his most important poems. Let's talk a little bit about Hamas. In 2006, there was an election, which you write in your book, resulted in a resounding upset for Hamas. They won 74 out of 132 seats. You noted international monitors certified the election as free and transparent, while voters viewed Hamas as relatively incorrupt. But they viewed Fatah, that is PLO, as Israel's subcontractor in occupied